Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, the ESPN College Football Podcast. The ESPN College Football Podcast is now 5 days a week. Hosts Kirk Herbstreit, David Pollack, and Kevin Negandhi are back and joined this year by Reese Davis, Matt Berry, Paul Feinbaum, Booger McFarland, and Joey Galloway. From weekend reaction to Monday mornings to previews, the ESPN College Football Podcast has it covered by the voices and perspectives you'll want to hear from. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Also, as the NFL season gets underway, make sure you're ready to kick off with TuneIn, the app that lets you listen to live games, in-depth analysis, and tailored content for your team all season long. Plus, with ESPN Radio on TuneIn, you can listen to comprehensive football coverage from NFL Live, fantasy-focused football, and more, all to fuel your football fandom. Download the TuneIn app today to start listening everywhere you go. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we have got an interview with Marcus Clark and Johnny Smith. They worked on a new documentary on Netflix called Blood Brothers about the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. Be sure to check that out. We'll talk to them, but first... All right, so it is the time of week where we have a guest join us, and we actually have 3 guests joining us, but first joining us now, check him out at, just everywhere, man. Channel 6, be sure to check out Channel 6, subscribe to that. Also, check out the Shutdown Fullcast, which is now on with Meadowlark Media on Saturday nights, wrapping up college football, the best college football writer in America, Spencer Hall. What's going on?
Hey, listen, Thinking Out Loud on the SEC Network,
yes,
7 p.m. Mondays. Full multimedia spectrum D-list star here, baby. Let's go.
My favorite thing about the Thinking Out Loud is the video clips going around and people realizing, oh no, that's on TV, baby.
No. You're like, they did it again. They actually brought us into a studio this time. So congratulations and good luck to them. Because, like, you know, once you get it, you're just like, I'll drive it like I stole it. You know, no apologies. You know, like, is that guy wearing a floral shirt on TV again? Yes. It's the only kind of button down I have. Sorry.
Hey, man, if they make the requirements, then you just got to roll with what I got, baby.
I'm telling you, I am so glad you called and wanted to talk, because there's only one person I want to talk about the most important story this week with, and that's you.
Oh, yeah. And we're coming off the top of that. We coming off the top of that. So there's this thing about Nick Saban that I've known. I can't remember the first time I found out, but I have known about this. And apparently other people did not know about this quite yet. Because something I think that people don't quite understand about Nick Saban is he's actually a human being, right? Like, he's not one of these guys that, I think Bill Belichick is kind of the same way, where we get what we get from them in media, but they're actually socially well-adjusted and know how to interact with people and, like, know how to feel those rhythms and jump in on it. They're just crazy football coaches. And so who was the player that was up at the press conference?
That would be Jordan Battle.
That was Jordan Battle. You have to forgive me. All them Alabama dudes are just dudes with numbers on their helmets. I have a very difficult time until about week 7 understanding the difference between them. Like, they just rolled out all the guys I had heard of, and now it's Bryce Young. Yeah, I don't think I know anybody else's name anymore on the team. I just know they're all really good.
That's the side effect of creating a machine, is that you don't really know any of the parts because they even all look the same. Alabama's wide receivers, same frame. They're all built the same. They recruit the same dude. They go to the store and they get exactly the produce they want. And it always looks the same. And this is the same case. Also, media availability, we don't get to talk to them that much. They get a little window, which is one of the things that makes this story so funny, is because you go, oh, that's Jordan Battle. And now we know what Jordan Battle sounds like and what he looks like, and we're never going to see him again.
Now, it's interesting because, like, Miami and Florida State, when they were the machines, right? Mm-hmm. We knew who the guys were. USC, when they were the machine. We knew who the guys were. And it's not like Alabama's out here recruiting anonymous people. They're recruiting people that folks have heard of as high school juniors. Didn't they slap on that crimson? You're all the same to me.
Yeah. Part of the machine. The process does not care about names. It only cares about results. Additionally, this is the first time I've seen, or maybe the second time. Quinnen Williams was the first time. This is the second time I have seen their media blackout, their extreme chokehold that they have over everything that happens in that program. This is the second time I've seen it slip. It's the funniest time I've seen it slip. And it's the first time I've seen it slip like during the season proper.
Now, I do have to say, though, Quinton Williams getting ready to say that Kyler Murray was a bum and then stopping himself and then them asking him to go deeper. Him saying, that's up there. that's up there. Because I met him very briefly. He was at the Seaport, because he got drafted that year and he came up there. And oh, my goodness, I never felt so old because he's so giant. But what's the word? Is it cherubic? Is that the word that you use for these guys that just seem like they're just great big old children? And he's the nicest, most polite guy in the world. And it made that moment even funnier because it was really like a 5-year-old being like, oh, I'm not supposed to talk about this outside the house. No. But what we got for Jordan Battle is Jordan Battle got up and let the world know that Nick Saban is a big fan of a good D's nuts joke, which makes Nick Saban all of us.
Yeah, God love him for that. If you want a relatable human being, I know at least three things about Nick Saban that are very relatable. One, he's got a weakness for junk food because his breakfast every morning is somehow 2 Little Debbie oatmeal pies. If you want to know the tribute to taking steps and how good it is for your health, Nick Saban, I imagine that man paces like 20,000 steps every day. He's gotten away with eating Little Debbie's for breakfast every morning for his entire adult life. Second thing that's super relatable is that he has a boat and enjoys going out on that boat, okay? So even he has the money to waste on a boat, but the sort of masculine impulse to waste money on a boat, that's something I find really relatable, Nick Saban. And the third, the dude loves a good D's nuts joke. Josh Jacobs, I believe, was the first one to come out and tell the world that he really loves a good D's nuts joke. When he told it, the reporters didn't even believe him. They're like, no, wait. Go back. And they're like, no. That's his favorite thing. He'll walk up and be like, yeah, D's nuts. This is his favorite thing. This is the first time I've heard a player go long on it, though.
So here's the thing for me, though, about Nick Saban and his affection for D's nuts jokes, which makes it the best and the worst at the same time, which is you kind of got to let him tell it even if you smoke it out, right? That's where I feel on this. Keeping in mind, Nick Saban is the man who plays pickup basketball where he decides who's on the teams. Now, never mind the fact that Nick Saban is not a very tall man. And so the idea of him having this great affection for basketball is pretty interesting because it doesn't seem like something that, you know, he would be into because it doesn't seem like basketball would be into him. But if he is the guy that picks the people on the team, like, you don't want to mess up on a Nick Saban bad day and think he's about to hit you with this D's nuts. And in fact, he's being dead serious. And now all of a sudden it's gassers for everybody. Like, you just have to ride this thing all the way out to the end. Or maybe Nick Saban appreciates somebody who can sniff that out and sees that as a person who can, like, read coverages. You know what I'm saying? Detect tendencies. And maybe that'll move you up on the depth chart. Maybe that's what he's checking for.
I got to assume I'm being manipulated for an effect at all times if I'm around Nick Saban. Because the man says and does everything in order to press a button on this beautiful machine that he has. If he gets angry in a press conference, he might really be angry, but he's going to point it in a direction that benefits his football program. And when he says something, the ear that he's speaking into is not mine or yours. It's the players. It's always the players. He's always trying to do that and send a message that way. So if the man is telling you a D's nuts joke, I might laugh. But I might also hesitate because I'm being tested.
Yes.
I'm being pushed in one direction. It's a game that I don't know if I can win because he's been playing it so long. It's going to be checkers v. chess.
Yes. Now, my question is, when did he start telling these? Like, has he been telling these since the 70s? Or did somebody, like, let him listen to The Chronic in 1992 and he decided he was going to put this in his arsenal? Or he heard his players doing it and was like, that's pretty clever.
I think he probably took notes on it and then went and listened to The Chronic. That's my guess. I think... We now need to consider the possibility that Nick Saban has at least had some exposure to West Coast rap. He might be current on things till 92, 93, because this is someone who's obsessive about their job in the sense of he really likes trying to relate to his players and knows his limits on doing that, but does all his homework. So, like, I know that he at least did some research on it. Like, there's no way.
I could totally see him being in The Chronic. And the reason I can is things I learned while doing local radio and things I kind of knew before. But, like, I went to school in a town called Waller, Texas. At the time I was there, population 1,493. Okay. Like, you know, we got a strong FFA program at Waller. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of blue corduroy jackets. Like, this is what it is. And you'd have people be like, I don't like rap except for Regulators and Doggy Style. Like that was the line that was drawn. And it made sense because that era of rap that particularly that wing is a lot of live instruments, right? And so the folks that are into country music could hear some things that kind of overlap with what the direction was, and it's just cold, right? Like white people have never had a problem appreciating black music. Black people, a little bit more. Black music, they could do it. But for whatever reason, the G-funk was the thing that cut through. And so I could just totally imagine like somewhere Nick Saban's out and he hears Doggy Dogg World for the first time. And he's like, I need to check that out. And then he goes and checks out Doggy Style and was like, okay, that was grooving. Well, tell me more about this guy. And then next thing you know, here is Nick Saban. Bow, wow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yay. Nick Saban in the house. I'd pay to see that.
Oh, 100%. Also, there's two entertaining things. One's real, one's hypothetical. One, Nick Saban's into music. Nick Saban is a huge fan of the Rolling Stones.
Really?
Yeah, there was a Warren St. John interview in GQ where he's discussing things with Nick Saban, and he makes a Mick Jagger joke like, that's Mick Jagger, just kind of an old guy running around the stage. And Saban, the eyes sort of turn flat, and he looks at him and goes, Mick Jagger's a great entertainer. Like, very seriously, right? Also, Bill Belichick and Nick Saban, when they were on the staff together with the Browns, they attended a Pink Floyd concert together.
Now, that's the shock.
Mm-hmm. I want you to please imagine these two listening to David Gilmour play the intro to Wish You Were Here, and just both of them getting a little emotional as that happens. Yeah, both of them went to a Pink Floyd concert together. Moments I would get the time machine out for so I could just sit and watch. That's one of them.
I want them for the second solo in Comfortably Numb, where I imagine that by that point in the concert, everybody is so far gone off whatever they came in there on. Meanwhile, Nick Saban and Bill Belichick, arms crossed. It's beautiful music. It's really beautiful music.
It's fantastic. Let's just look at that. You know, we got to break this down later. we got to run it back and figure out how it works. That's what I see them doing, right? Just going like, yeah, no, we got to go back and listen to this in the car, man, because this is deep. The second thing, the hypothetical too, by the way, he had a grad assistant do this, right? He's like, yeah, listen, I got to get all up on Snoop Dogg. I need you to listen to everything he's done and just get back to me with the top three tracks so I can talk to the players, right? So some GA's just sitting there like, yeah, this knocks. This is good, man. Yeah.
I think you saw this, the Howard Schnellenberger, Mick Jagger story when he was at Louisville. And for people who don't know this, that the Stones were playing one of their stadium tours. And the thing about their stadium tours is it involves playing a bunch of colleges, because a lot of these towns, where else do they have a stadium, right? And the Stones would play anywhere that you tell them you could pack in 50, 60, 70,000 people. And so they were playing a show at stadium in Louisville. And Mick Jagger wanted to do his workout. And so he was in the weight room at Louisville doing his workout. And Howard Schnellenberger, who was one of these guys who takes pride in not knowing, or was rather, rest in peace, takes pride in not knowing anything about pop culture, doesn't know who Mick Jagger is, and runs him out. Right? He's just like, yo, get out of there. And they say Mick Jagger runs out of there and he's scared. And the players are like, yo, what are you doing? That's Mick Jagger. And they explain to Schnellenberger how much money he's got. And Schnellenberger's like, huh. And then next thing you know, he's got his arm around Mickey, I believe is what he was calling him, giving him the tour because he got the bright idea that maybe he could get Mick Jagger to give him some money. And I'm imagining it, Nick Saban instead coming in and just fanboying out at the sight of Mick Jagger.
It's really nice to meet you, Mr. Jagger. It's just doing the hand gestures with him. Yeah. Listen, I don't know if I like, you know, Nick, you don't know if you like anybody because you never hang out with these guys. And when you see him, they're so coach mode that you're not sure what's under there. He's fascinating, though. Nick Saban is fascinating for a lot of different reasons, where he came from, how he got there. And then the fact that every now and then, dude surprises you. Like, you know, he took accordion lessons when he was a kid. Chris Vernon in Memphis has always had an accordion, or on a couple of occasions, had an accordion waiting at SEC Media Days because he wants to see Nick play it. Nick keeps dodging him because, like, he doesn't want to look silly, I think. Because nobody looks cool playing the accordion. Like, it's just not possible. You can look okay, but you can't look cool. And I don't think Nick wants that, but, like, apparently he can play the accordion, at least a little.
Well, he would like to play the accordion and not have to watch himself play the accordion for the rest of his life. Right? Like, correct. That's the issue there, is that you'll never stop running this joke.
No.
Like, I hang out with Dan Levitar. That's the problem with them. It's like, okay, I was down for this the first 18 times.
But we're getting it 36.
Yeah. Like, guys, you don't have anything new? And Dan's like, no, we don't ever have anything new. Like, that's not what we do. We just do the same thing over and over and over again. What are you, new here?
Yeah. Do you not get the show, Bo?
Oh, man.
Get
the show? It is another thing about saving a little bit more nuts and bolts college football, but still, I brought this up, and we're a little bit beyond it, but I still have this. how much money has to be paid to make it worth it for you to play Alabama week one? Because I'm not doing it, man. Like, every year somebody signs up for this sacrifice.
Okay, can we just use the current example? Miami goes in and they get destroyed. Alabama could have picked the score. They let that happen. They could have made that score whatever they wanted to. So week two, you go, well, how bad is it going to be? Well, it's going to be bad enough that you almost lose to App State at home, right? You barely beat App State at home. That's the hangover that you get, right? Which I think is like 2 weeks to 4 weeks. It's somewhere in that like 2 weeks to a month. And then you kind of regain your footing after you lose, you know, so much depth potential and just the general shock and awe of playing a team that much better than you. So how much money does it have to be worth? I don't know. You got to be one of those programs who really needs it.
I mean, just every year somebody gets it. And yeah, Miami's the one who got it this year. And I don't think I told you the analogy that I use is why, like, this is what's going to happen. In 87, when the NFL had that strike, Jerry Rice had 21 touchdown catches and a touchdown run in a 12-game season. And you know exactly what happened. It was a strike. People like, man, we ain't going to come back. So they out here working out a little bit, lollygagging or whatever. Jerry Rice doing then what he probably did this morning, running that hill every single day. You're not ready? Oh, no. Jerry Rice, always ready whenever you say it. And that's the thing about Alabama. You can tell Alabama that their first game is July 15th, and you don't have to tell them till July 1. It will look exactly the same as it did the first week of September when they got out there to play, because they are always ready in case a game breaks out.
There's no good time to face the bear or to poke said bear, but if I had to do it, let's hit them late October. That's what I want. I want to hit you late October. I want to hit you first week of November. I want you when you are in the middle of preparation for so many other things that maybe I catch you sleeping a little. Maybe you've had an injury at cornerback or at defensive end or at linebacker where you're a step slower than you might be, or at least a step less prepared. Because you know they're not slower. I said slower, and then I thought, nah. Everybody, remember, we go to the store, we get the produce we want. Everybody runs the exact same 4.5 or 4.6 they need to run at that position. So week one, I'm the only thing you're focusing on the whole offseason. That's a problem for me. Demonstrably, because that game nobody's going to play. I mean, they're not going to play that game in, you know, like a couple of years. They're done with those because no one of worth is going to do it. You know, they had to play Duke a couple of years ago in that game when Duke is the only one to do it and is like, hey, facility upgrades, y'all. Facility, I know this is going to hurt, but we're going to get the shiniest new building or field out of this. Yeah, that's a sign that no one else has taken the bait.
Duke has not been the same, by the way, since that game. And what's wild about it is Duke is still so far from where they came, because they played against Alabama at Duke in 2010. Duke went up there and played a game, and one of my former students was on the sideline for that game. And he said to those dudes for Alabama were on the field like, talking about what we're going to do when we get back, man. Oh, okay, cool. And then the ball snapped, and then they just go erase somebody. And at least Duke is better than that. Like, you can't do that against them anymore.
You might be slightly out of breath them now.
Yeah, yeah, like totally possible. USC, I forget what year it was they played them. Now, granted, their thing was already a little wobbly, but, you know, they got caught out in that same situation and they got beat down at Jerry World. And now they just got around to firing their head coach. And people started breaking out the, hey, what about Urban Meyer to come to this job? And should we lay out all the reasons that Urban Meyer is not going to get that job? Number one being an athletic director, maybe does that. A university president at a school that is up under a massive settlement that they're paying out for treating women poorly on campus. Nope. Yeah. Sorry, this guy can't come here. Not now. Oh, no.
$1 billion settlement in total.
With a B. With a B. Just so you heard. With a B.
With a B. Yeah. This is one of the reasons that won't happen. Another reason that won't happen is because I feel very hesitant in saying I know anything that is in the head of the decision makers at USC. Or even if the AD has that much power. I know the AD has the power to fire Helton, but I'm also unsure of who exactly pulls the strings, because this has been the case at USC that we're unsure of who's making the decisions, who has the actual sway, and of what their thinking is. Because their thinking over the past 20 years has been bizarre. And maybe past that, like if we went past that and looked back, we'd probably go, well, that was pretty weird too. Because USC, very insular, a much smaller community. It's a private school. It doesn't have quite so many hands on the wheel as a large public institution, right? Like USC and Texas are comparable in the sense that they are both powers that have, by and large, over the past 20, 30 years, underachieved, given their resources where they are and their historical performance as football programs, right? Texas more so due to squandering all those resources, yes. Right? Flagship university in a football mad state that somehow manages to pile up very few trophies for all of the effort, time, and concentration it puts on football. USC's different because they've got those. They've got those laurels. But the lows and the inconsistencies and the decision-making has just been strange. Like, they hired Lane Kiffin 3 times. They hired, I know the names are different, but they hired Lane Kiffin 3 different times. They hired Lane Kiffin.
Yeah,
they hired Lane Kiffin 2, and then they hired Lane Kiffin 0, or Diet Lane Kiffin, in Clay Helton, right? Offensive guy. They didn't even do what programs do where you sort of yo-yo back and forth between, you know, okay, now we got a defensive guy. No, now we need an offensive guy. No. USC was just like, we'll just hire different versions of the same offensive guy 3 times in a row. There's an Ogeron sprinkled in there too, just in case that's weird, because your interim coach, you know, demonstrated a surprising level of competence in leading your program back from the brink and from an ugly season, and everybody liked it, and then they just let him go and hired another Lane Kiffin. They did that for 3 coaches in a row, and I don't think the idea of Urban Meyer in LA is tenable on a lot of grounds, but one is this: he still has a job
for now
in the middle of the season, right? An NFL job. What you're proposing is that you would go, oh, we're going to have another Bobby Petrino incident. That's what this would be. Maybe Urban would say goodbye to his players in this scenario, this fantastic scenario. But you're also assuming that Urban would give up in what? We're after week 1. We're in week 2, right? We're assuming that he would give it up for a job where he would be unwelcome and entering a place where a lot of, you know, pretty good coaches have failed to live up to expectations in the recent history. So, yeah, this is fantasy, like rank fantasy. I think that's just pulling a name. This is my favorite thing. When you hire a new coach, everybody puts a list together. And you know what this list is? It's a list of good dogs, right? If you ask dogs to write a list of, like, you know, hey, who's a good dog? All of these coaches come up and they're like, I'm a good dog. I would like a treat. And that treat is in the form of either hire me or get me an extension. That's what it is. Like, if you look at this list, it's just a bunch of guys go to their agents going, I'm a very good dog and I think I need a treat, right? Like, and they go to a reporter and they'll say, hey, definitely interested in that job. Or their agent or somebody leaks to that reporter and goes, you know, that might be a good spot for them. Really, all it is the coaches just get together and saying, I would like a treat. I will sit here patiently and I will wait for said treat, or I will start barking.
I do have to say, though, Urban looks good and miserable.
It's bad.
Really unhappy.
I did this because I'm a bad person. If you just search Urban Meyer on Sundays, half the comments are like, oh, he's going to die. Like just people, like the expression on his face, and then the screen caps you get is just a man mired in a misery he has never experienced as a head coach before.
I mean, he basically realized that he is now the coach of Vanderbilt, that he knows this because he basically went out and lost to Mississippi State.
Mm-hmm. Immediately. I mean, game 1.
Thoroughly.
That reality check. I've seen 2 coaches crack me up with the look of absolute shock on their face at how bad things have gone. One is Steve Sarkisian on that 4th-and-1 against Arkansas, because the camera zoomed in and they had him framed up, and that looked like a shook man. That looked like a guy who was like, oh, it's worse than I even thought. And the second is any shot of Urban Meyer. There was a shot where they completed a pass and Urban Meyer was turned full away from the field yelling at someone in his headset. And this is somebody who is a control freak. Meyer is notorious for doing his assistant's jobs or micromanaging when things get tough, because he believes he's the one who can fix it, which at the college level, I think that's a more helpful instinct than it is at the professional level, particularly when you're dealing with players. So that instinct is just going to drive, that's going to drive him mad there. And along with, you know, being the Jags.
I thought that he would be able to come to terms with the reality that, hey, it's just a little different here. You know, like you're not going to win the way that you won at the last place. That's just it. The NFL doesn't work that way. Like, yeah, 10-3 would be really bad at your last job. Pretty damn good at this job, right? I thought that he would be able to just simply make sense of that reality. Incorrect.
Well, in college, we got 4 months on the field, and then you have 8 months of please come to my university. That's really what it is. You're just endlessly recruiting. Ed Ogeron, when he went to the Saints after leaving USC, said that he had way more free time as a professional coach than he had as a college coach. That is nuts to me, because the NFL is full of these, like, you know, legendary nose to the grindstone, I watch tape 14 hours a day kind of dudes. But it's a different kind of grind, you know, in terms of recruiting. Like, Urban was used to going out and not losing a recruiting battle. Ohio State, look at what Ohio State, like, Ryan Day came in, got the keys, and I know he's recruited well, and I know he's, you know, coached that team up, but he really didn't have to if he didn't want to. He probably could have taken a year and just coasted on that, right? Because you just have so much talent, and it's so much better than your opposition. I don't know if you can turn that off, right? That's taking 2/3 of your ability to do the job and turning it into nothing. Nothing. You just have to roster, you know, you have to evaluate. It's a completely different skill set, which is why you see a lot of successful college coaches go to the pros and fail, you know, and come short.
I tell you this, though, boy, somebody go over there to USC and get that thing cracking, and the thing will crack. And the reason I say that is I was thinking about all of the deals that Reggie Bush got as a rookie in the NFL. He would have gotten all of them as a junior at USC.
Yeah.
A junior.
Yeah. This is just math. Like, when people say, well, you know, USC doesn't have to be good now. USC doesn't, you know, like, this doesn't have to be 2000. Things are different now. The sport's different now. Nothing has changed about Los Angeles. You know how many people there are? That's a 12 million person metropolitan area. 12 million. If I get every other really talented player in the top 25, top 50 coming out of LA, I win. I win. That's just math, especially in a state where you kind of forget California. It's right up there with Texas and Florida in terms of both population and a real commitment to the sport. It's one of those places where people still play it, where people still take high school seriously, where there's still, like, marquee high schools, right? Like, modern day. This is a place where if you get who you're supposed to get, that's 9, 8, 10 wins every single year. And then on top of that, capital, money, endorsements, like, well, Los Angeles and endorsements. What about those two terms does not form a pleasant marriage in the mind? Nothing. Reggie Bush should have been a millionaire coming out of college, right? Like, he jokes that, you know, like, he had, you know, you go to USC, you have the professional experience anyway. They'd all have the professional ledger. They'd all have the bank balance coming out as well.
And the hood still love them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is important. The hood still loves USC, where they're different than Miami. Like, I don't think USC leaned into it necessarily, but where Miami's been like, oh man, you know, we kind of got to deal with the hood here. No. USC has just been like, yo, yeah, that's right. We're the University of South Central. You are correct.
Also, USC football and athletics in general, of all of the things going on there institutionally, football's been among the least embarrassing. Consider that at USC, you couldn't really fake your way on being on the football team because you'd get wiped off the field. It just simply wouldn't happen. It's not like, you know, the water polo team or the tennis team or whatever. Sorry, like, USC water polo is actually really good. That's a terrible example. That's also, by the way, when you talk about USC, what kind of an institution are we dealing with? You're like, it's a place with an amazing water polo team. And you go, ah, okay. California, wealthy, kind of a relaxing experience, if we're going to be honest, once you get in, right? Nobody's paying that much money to have a bad time.
That is real talk, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, 100%. Also, this is the other thing. Locally competition, do you think UCLA is ever going to, you think UCLA is ever going to trump them? Like, if you just look at it, what do we have to offer, right? UCLA, public institution, right? Takes itself very seriously as a public institution. Basketball school first, historically speaking, right? If you're a football player, you might be a good deal. might be fine. UCLA might be a pretty good experience. Oh, I get to, you know, get coached by Chip Kelly, and I get to play in the Rose Bowl, which is like 30,000 miles away from the actual campus, right? Or I could go to USC, where chances are, if I talk to the players, they'll be like, oh, it's a good time. It's a fantastic time. You should do this. Same weather, different experience with some slightly different requirements, and I get drafted. And I get drafted, and I win 8, 9, 10 games.
Like, a big part of the O.J. Simpson story and all those endorsements is what going to USC can do for you. That it don't seem to carry over the same way with UCLA. Like, you let me know if I'm wrong.
No, it does not. It does not carry over the same way. It's a different set of people. It's a different historical silo, like, just culturally, in terms of what things mean. Like, USC, when you go, like, well, isn't UCLA isn't Los Angeles. They're just as much the Hollywood University, right? They've got just as much glamour. No, Westwood ain't the same. It is not the same experience. When you go, okay, well, what if we take O.J. Simpson out of it for many reasons? What if we just take him out of consideration? It's like, that's your typical USC player. I have many more to choose from, right? I've got Marcus Allen. We could do Reggie Bush. And we can do Matt Leinart.
That's what I was about to say. Matt Leinart's on TV.
We could sleep on Matt Leinart being at one time, like, maybe as famous as Reggie Bush coming out of college. It was point for point. Like, I don't think people were like, ah, that team is just Reggie Bush. We tend to remember teams by just one dude, you know, especially when we should, like Auburn, Cam Newton, or Bo Jackson, right? Can you name anyone else from those two teams? No. But that USC team was so talented that you could name at least Leinart, if not Lindell White,
yeah,
off that same team.
Dwayne Jarrett, if you're trying to show off.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to stunt, do Dwayne Jarrett, right? If you're like me, you want to go, hey, Brandon Hancock, just because he's jacked. He's absolutely jacked. It's like the most jacked football player I've ever seen in my life is Brandon Hancock. But point being, they've got marquee names. UCLA, go back and tell me. Who we got? UCLA, are you going to do Cade McNown? We're going to go back that far? We're going to do Maurice Jones-Drew?
The biggest star they've had as a football player post-Troy Aikman was Jamal Stokes.
Yeah. Yeah. J.J. Stokes. Or, you know, Miles Jack. Like, but even Miles Jack, like, Miles Jack is, you know, like, I kind of had to dig. He's like a page two guy, even though he's not a page two player in my mind.
Nah.
And he played both ways at UCLA. But consider this. They had a two-way wonder at UCLA, and they were still kind of second billing at the time to an underperforming USC team. So, yeah, like, when your page three guy is Juju Smith-Schuster, we're talking about a different level of, like, wattage. It's not the same. I'm selling myself on USC, by the way. I'm like, yeah, anyone should take Urban should take this job. He should go for it.
But their biggest difficulty, and this is, like, the hardest thing to explain a lot of times to people, is if you're an assistant coach, people are like, yo, the quality of living of in Los Angeles, your quality of living will be much higher in, I mean, as crazy as it sounds, like Waco, Texas, or one of those places, than being an assistant at USC, just because you can't afford to live there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an apartment life. Go ahead and get yourself, like, reconciled to that, or a tremendous commute. I mean, I think Lane Kiffin was commuting in from Huntington Beach.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, or like way out on the beach, man. He was commuting way in every single day. I don't know if he, like, slept in his office or whatever, but, like, he was coming a long way. So, yeah, like, there are challenges to being an assistant at USC. You're still in L.A. It's fine. Also, you're probably going to get the head coaching job. But think about that. In 3 or 4 years, who are they going to hire? An assistant. You know, when things go sideways, hang around. See what happens, right? Those guys all get gigs. It's fine. Professionally, being an assistant at USC, very indicative of a successful, long coaching career and possibly getting the head job. Because, you know, they like doing that. They don't like to look too far. They're like, hey, you already got a key to the building. Why don't you come on down? Be the head coach.
Well, the question, I think, at this time when they hire coaches, what are they going to bring both of them in there?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm.
These nuts.
Perfect.
Full circle.
I walked right into that.
Full circle.
I walked right into
that. Yes.
I thought you were going to ask me about the BOFA Center. You know, they just opened the BOFA Center.
Hey, man, I'm proud of myself. And ladies and gentlemen, that is Spencer Hall. Check him out. Thinking Out Loud, SEC Network.
Dirty.
Check out the Shutdown Fullcast. Check him out on Saturday night. Check out Channel 6. Oh, man, I'm so proud of myself for the way that we made that work. And now we will, of course, come off of that very lighthearted moment with a very serious discussion of Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. All right, got to tell you guys to check this out. It's a documentary on Netflix right now you can check out called Blood Brothers. It's an adaptation of a great book by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. And that book was on the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. Netflix now has that doc up. It's been available for a few days. Be sure to go check that out. And joining us now, we have Johnny Smith, co-author of the book, and Marcus Clark, the director of the documentary. And first, I want to throw it to, you know, whichever one of you guys wants to take this, is the process of getting this film made. What was that like?
Yeah, serious process here for this one. We had Ken Ubaris and Lightbox actually purchase the rights to the book Blood Brothers, written by Randy Roberts and Johnny Smith. You know, after they did that, they were looking for a director to tell the story and how they would approach kind of the storytelling. And I came in and basically gave Kenya my opinion on how I would approach this type of a story. What are the key elements? What are the key moments? What are some of the conventions we can use to get into the story? Which one of those was the regret element and the remorse element, kind of using that as a jumping off point to get into the story. And soon after kind of pitching how I'd approach the project, I was tapped to direct it, and we started moving forward on all the research and all the kind of preliminary production stuff that you would do to get a documentary off the ground.
You know, I think it's interesting on this that I think the relationship between Ali and Malcolm X is something that's generally known, but the particulars of the falling out, I think, kind of got skipped over in the history of both of them in the retelling really over the last 30 or 40 years. So how interesting was it for both of you guys, like, to really get to this and realize that I think a lot of people are going to learn something they thought they knew about, but not really?
You know, I think that's an interesting point. I was asked a similar question yesterday about the breakup and how that happened. And I think there were a lot of myths around how the relationship fragmented. And so one of the things that Randy and I tried to do the book, and I think is captured well in the Netflix documentary, is to show in detail how the politics of the Nation of Islam, this feud between Malcolm X and the leader of the nation, Elijah Muhammad, created Muhammad Ali. You know, the renaming of Muhammad Ali was undoubtedly a political act by Elijah Muhammad, and Ali becomes a pawn in this power struggle between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad. When you have both of these black nationalist leaders, you saw that it was Ali who could help them build their respective movements. But ultimately, Ali was forced to make a choice. And although he had this close bond with Malcolm X, instead of going with this man that he once proclaimed was his brother, he remained in the arms of Elijah Muhammad, the paternal figure in the movement of the Nation of Islam.
Yeah, and I think it's a tricky thing when talking about the legacies of both of them is that, you know, prior to 1964 with Malcolm and prior to Ali leaving the Nation of Islam, nobody got to really speak for themselves, right? Like, everything Malcolm X said was prefaced with "the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us," and then goes from there. And I thought it was interesting that once Malcolm became his own independent figure, Ali became the most visible follower. And both of them are marked by a particular courage, but it also was a courage that did not come with leading. It's like dedicated soldiers.
You know, after the 1964 fight between Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston, he gives this press conference where he talks about how, "I don't have to be who you want me to be. I'm free to be me." And in a sense, yes, he had broken the political boundaries of the sports world. This was him challenging the convention that black athletes should be seen and not heard. And so he was asserting a new kind of political independence. But that freedom, that independence, was restricted. It came with limits. He was supposed to espouse the message of Elijah Muhammad and the other ministers in the Nation of Islam. And the longer that he remained in the movement, he came to recognize, as Malcolm X did in 1963, 1964, that he would never, ever be truly free until he broke away from the Nation of Islam.
Right. And Marcus, I think one thing that the film did a good job of touching on, and I thought, like, One Night in Miami, which obviously is a highly fictionalized account, but I thought one thing that they got a bit wrong in that or didn't highlight adequately enough is, there's a serious age difference between these two gentlemen where Malcolm is existing as a big brother. And what was it like for you to kind of like go through that? And as you kind of see this and recognize that we're not really talking about peers here.
That's right. That's a really important element that I don't think people have really factored into the story, which is Malcolm X is 17 years older than Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali. And so to your point, he does have a greater understanding of the world, a greater understanding of how to navigate the world as a black man. And he has a much more thorough understanding of the teachings of Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. And so, you know, when people look at this moment in Muhammad Ali's life it's important to remember how young he was going through all of these situations and trying to navigate the world and trying to make really pivotal decisions with his life. You know, I don't know what you were doing at 22, but for me, that would have been incredibly challenging to try to make, quote unquote, the right decision. You know, it's a lot of pressure there. There's a lot of different factors involved in this relationship. So, you know, as Maryam Ali says, this wasn't a simple decision. There's a lot of different factors to take into account. And I do think people have to be aware that Malcolm really was, you know, a mentor to him.
And another thing I thought the film did a good job of making clear was the obvious pain that this rift seemed to cause the two of them. So I was curious, like one process I'm always curious about with making documentaries is going through the archival footage, because as a viewer, there's always something that I, you know, we had never seen before. And I thought it was just very interesting that you could always see the pain on each of their faces whenever they talked about this situation after the fact.
Yeah, the archival material really underscores the fabric of the relationship, right? And that goes from seeing this admiration that they had for each other, this joy that they seem to be experiencing together. You know, as I've mentioned before, you know, some of these archival moments with the joy, some of them look like the happiest moments in their lives. They're sharing something. There's a mutual respect and a mutual admiration that just radiates off of the imagery. But on the other hand, when we get to some of these issues of the betrayal and when this relationship kind of goes sour, like you said, you can also see pain. And for me, one of the things I think is really interesting is as they're on the outs, you can see they're trying to hold on to this relationship. It's like they don't just let it go. Ali is still trying to say, hey, yeah, I know he said some stuff. I know he made, you know, he might have made some mistakes, but he's my brother, no matter what he does. And so there really was this moment in time where they were really trying to hold on to this relationship. And of course, we know where that goes. But when it's really sour, you know, you see the pain, you see the anger and the frustration kind of bottles up within Ali. And if you remember, you know, towards the top of the film, there's that clip at Muhammad Ali's training camp in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania, in which he says, Judas betrayed Jesus like Malcolm X betrayed Elijah Muhammad. Now, that's 8 years after X's assassination, and he still has this anger that he's holding on to and this frustration. And so while that clip is pretty shocking, I think it underscores just how complicated and difficult all of these emotions were and shows kind of how those emotions later on in his life turned into remorse and regret, kind of causing him to make a symbolic gesture to the Shabazz.
Yeah, and I feel like the third major character in this is not simply Elijah Muhammad the man, but like the power of Elijah Muhammad, which is kind of interesting because Malcolm X, for obvious reasons, you're going to have retelling of who he was at the time because he was such a towering figure. And, you know, the irony of Elijah Muhammad is like, at least physically or when you see him, towering is never the direction that you would go in. But Johnny, for people who know the name and know what he did, but don't quite understand it, like what was the magnitude of Elijah Muhammad at that time?
You raise a great point. If you listen to Elijah Muhammad give a speech in one of these archival clips, you scratch your head and think hundreds of people in the audience are clapping and applauding for this man who's not all that inspiring. So where does it come from? Well, Elijah Muhammad was someone who proclaimed that he was Allah's messenger, that he knew God, that God was a black man who had inhabited the earth. But then after God disappeared, that made Elijah Muhammad his messenger. And so in other words, he had presented himself as divine. Now, in the Nation of Islam's theology, everything that Elijah Muhammad said was supposed to be essentially coming from the word of God. And so there's this mythology around the wisdom of Elijah Muhammad. And I think as you brought up this point about the breakup between Ali and Malcolm and the pain and the anger that we see from Ali towards Malcolm, part of that was sustained because of religious reasons. In the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X, after he left the movement, was marked a hypocrite. And inside the movement, a hypocrite was deemed someone who had presented themselves as a true believer of Allah, but had betrayed Allah. And therefore, if you were in the movement and you believed in Elijah Muhammad's word as divine and you believed on Allah, hypocrites had to be eliminated. And so here you have Muhammad Ali, who believes in the word of the messenger, believes that Malcolm X was really a hypocrite, and that therefore Malcolm must pay for the crime of turning his back on Elijah Muhammad, Allah's messenger.
Yeah, and as we go with this, because I think for a lot of people, they kind of stop thinking about Elijah Muhammad as that figure with the death of Malcolm X, because I think at this point, the historical relevance that most people place on Muhammad is with his relationship with Malcolm X. But, you know, especially with Ali, they had control of Ali's career, I want to say, for another 10 years.
Absolutely. Herbert Muhammad, who was Elijah Muhammad's son, was essentially Ali's boxing manager. he controlled the purses, and Ali would get frustrated because a big chunk of the money that he was earning from his matches was going into the coffers of the Nation of Islam. So going back to this idea of how free was Ali, well, financially, he's constrained by what the Nation of Islam is asking of him. But that goes back to the point of why the Nation of Islam wanted Ali in the first place. You know, before Ali became heavyweight champion, Elijah Muhammad would tell his followers, don't go to boxing matches, don't watch them on TV, don't gamble on these matches. Boxing is simply an entity controlled by the white man to exploit poor black and brown men. But clearly, the fact that young Cassius Clay keeps coming back to the nation's mosque, he's seen with the ministers, he's constantly with Captain Sam Saxon in the mosque in Miami, he's not going away. And his value as a commodity, potential face of the movement, grows with each match as he moves closer and closer to the heavyweight title. And of course, once he defeats Sonny Liston, which Elijah Muhammad did not think he was going to do, now suddenly his value is limitless in the eyes of Elijah Muhammad.
I do love the idea, though, that Muhammad's telling people don't watch boxing, but knows enough to have an opinion about who is actually going to win this fight. How you know that, buddy? How you know that, right? Right, right. Oh, okay. He has got the message. I get you. I see what it is. I also wonder this about Ali. He is perhaps the most charming human being who has ever walked the face of the earth. Like, as I hear the things you talk about, you know, with the problem that the nation has with hypocrites, and of course, they're talking about it in a fairly particular way, but that is a criticism that many have made of Ali over time. And we all just kind of let it ride because he's just so damn likable. It never failed at any turn, right? Like, this is the pro-black man who also called Joe Frazier a monkey in front of everybody and got everybody to laugh at the same time while this is going on. And I almost wonder to a degree if, even as steely and stoic as Elijah Muhammad could have been, he also got charmed by Muhammad Ali. And it's like, ah, well, this one ain't so bad.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. You know, with Ali's kind of rising stock, rising tide, I think the potential of who he could influence and his reach was something that was probably very appealing. With Malcolm kind of on the outs, kind of formally serving as that role, you know, Malcolm spread the word. He helped open a lot of nation's mosques. He helped spread the word across the country. And so he was really pivotal in terms of bringing in new members and exposing the message to more people in the country. And so with that absence, I think there's definitely an opportunity, so to speak.
And you mentioned in 1973 that Ali was still saying that, you know, like Judas betrayed Jesus, Malcolm X betrayed Elijah Muhammad, but eventually there was a thaw. Is there any inflection point that brings us to understanding why Ali eventually came to forgive?
Yeah, so from my experience talking to the family and kind of going through this whole production, there's an overlap between when Elijah Muhammad passes away and Ali taking another trip to Mecca, you know, another kind of spiritual awakening. And around that time period, it starts to transition to a more traditional form of Islam. You know, it just so happened to be around the time Elijah Muhammad's passing. So many can speculate on, you know, how much of an influence that was or whether or not it was out of respect that he stayed in the nation that long. But that starts to change the tide with him. And as he kind of comes into his own, hindsight, looking back on these things, the anger starts to change into regret. We learn from the daughters of Malcolm X that he reaches out to them and actually forms a new bond and a new relationship with Malcolm X's children, most notably Atala Shabazz, the eldest daughter of Malcolm X, and then also Ilyasa Shabazz, who graciously shared that story in the documentary. And, you know, that's a really powerful gesture. It's really symbolic. And as she says in the film, it's likely that to then be there and to play this role, you know, as his brother, to be in their lives. And so, you know, I think it's a symbolic gesture that kind of underscores this journey, this emotional journey that Muhammad Ali went through.
And I think it's also worth noting that Ali thawed, but man, a whole lot of other people did not. I was struck by the number of people after all these years who were in the documentary who still seem pretty heated about all of this.
I did an interview for the book with the man that we know as Captain Sam Saxon, Abdul Rahman, and his son appears in the documentary because he's passed away. And I did the interview here in Atlanta, and we sat down and I was asking him these questions about Malcolm's, you know, break from Elijah Muhammad and the movement. And the way he talked about him, as some of the other members of the Nation of Islam have continued to talk about him, is that he got what was coming to him. And there's this, like you say, that flame is never burned out. And it speaks to the loyalty to Elijah Muhammad. And so I think that when we see that clip from Muhammad Ali in 1973, you know, clearly that fire burned with him as well. He got angered when reporters and television broadcasters asked him about his relationship with Malcolm X. Like, he would get defensive, visibly agitated that, how dare you ask me about this? And he would reference that, you know, you white reporters, you didn't care for Malcolm X when he was alive, but now that he's dead, you're out here treating him like a martyr. And so Ali got defensive. And you have to wonder where that defensiveness really comes from. Was it because, in his mind, you know, he knew that the Nation of Islam had been involved? I don't know. He never spoke to that.
I just remember seeing the gentleman sitting there and just listening to them talk. It was really like it was, in fact, yesterday that, you know, that this sort of thing had happened. Now, one thing I was curious about, one figure that doesn't really come up a lot or much in the doc, I was just curious about, is Farrakhan is not really a prominent figure in the discussions that we have. And one thing I had never really known is if there was any relationship between he and Ali that was worth discussing.
Yeah, from my research, there definitely seems to be a relationship between he and Ali. From what I understand, it seemed to form after the specific time period that film, which is 1962 to 65. As you can see, towards the end of the film in the archival material, the proximity of Muhammad Ali and Farrakhan gets a little closer and closer. But unfortunately, we weren't able to tap into that storyline or any information about their specific relationship. And I believe most of it formed after the relationship he had with Malcolm. Now, it should be noted that at some point he was a student of Malcolm X, and so he was definitely present.
All right, and one last thing I want to ask you guys before we go, and just for people where I have to remember that we're seeing a bit of a flood of Ali content right now, but it's worth noting that for those of us, like, what more can you say about Ali? There are also a lot of people that are still like pretty new to this, and I'm trying to think what in the world would be analogous to Muhammad Ali winning the heavyweight championship and then telling the world that he was a member of the Nation of Islam shortly thereafter. Like, I'm trying to think of what would have to happen today that would be as seismic as that was. You guys got any ability to try to relate that?
Here's what I'll say about that. I think you're right. I think we haven't had a moment like that yet. I will say that something like, you have to look at someone like Colin Kaepernick and consider what he's been going through and what he's been doing in the relationship with kind of the people who've come before him and his legacy. He's not necessarily Muhammad Ali, but he's something like it. And when you look at how history changes the legacy, I would not be surprised if their fear and respect Muhammad Ali questioned Colin Kaepernick's decision to kneel. And so we have to look at these moments of defiance, these moments of speaking truth to power, to kind of connect those dots. But I don't think there's a similar image.
I would just add that I don't know if I have the analogy for you, Bomani, but here's something that I would point to in the past. When Cassius Clay won the heavyweight championship in 1964, and he openly declared that he was a loyal follower of Elijah Muhammad, Martin Luther King Jr. took a stance against him. He said that Cassius Clay now represents a champion of what we're fighting against. In other words, what Martin Luther King was saying is that here is Muhammad Ali, who has positioned himself in opposition to the integrationist civil rights movement. And so in this moment, you have the most prominent African-American leader in America saying that Muhammad Ali is no role model. Black America should not look up to him. And I think that story is powerful because it reminds us that long before Muhammad Ali was seen as a universal American hero, he was not only a controversial figure in white America, but he was a polarizing figure in Black America as well. And it wasn't until Ali's anti-war stance in 1967 that he and King found common ground in fighting against a colonial war in Vietnam.
Man, I had to tell everybody, be sure to check this out. Blood Brothers, you can find it on Netflix right now. Story of the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. We've had Marcus Clark, the director of the documentary, and Johnny Smith, co-author of the source text book called Blood Brothers, written by he and Randy Roberts. I encourage you guys to check that out. And thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you.
All right. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this here three times a week. Gabe Bassain and Dave Presley handling things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.